It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it's monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 4.5.
Walking a fine line between Fae and Fallen so we don't get into trouble.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And today we have Stina Light. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
So you're the author of Blood and Honey, and which we're going to talk about today. So I guess the first thing to start with is tell us a bit about yourself, sort of what brought you to writing, what drew you to writing about, you know, potato farmers, I mean, Irish folks and fantasy, that kind of stuff.
Now. well, what drew me to writing? I pretty much always wanted to be a writer. Storytelling kind of runs in my family through my great grandmother. And so I always wanted to be a writer. And I started my first novel when I was like in seventh grade or something silly. And then my father decided to tell me that that wasn't one of those things that girls should be doing. So I stopped. And then I started playing D&D in college because I thought it was like the closest thing to writing that I could get to, you know, that was accessible.
Always a huge mistake, I just have to say.
I loved it. It was a blast. I ran the same campaign for 16 years with...
Wow.
For 9 years... Yes, for a nine-year section with the same players, and then I moved up here to Austin and then ran it for, the remaining years with another set of players.
I'm sorry, I have to, you know, say that that's very impressive. I mean, my dad has been playing for, I think, 32 years, something like that, basically since I was born. And I started playing when I was about 12, but I didn't have that kind of staying power. And he's actually been playing with the same group for that entire time, but whenever I hear people who actually manage to, you know, stick it out with the same group and play for long periods of time, and obviously the same campaign, that must have given you a ton of practice in the whole storytelling thing.
Oh, absolutely. I definitely point to that when that experience when I talk about writing. I mean, everybody talks about how you need to write those 1 million bad words to finally get to a point where you're good. We didn't just play in person. We also played online. So I typed a lot of dialogue, and that's how I got a lot of practice making dialogue different from one character to the next, because it was the only way. I mean, we were working in a very rudimentary program at the time.
Right.
And so the only way that they really knew how to discern one character from another was through dialogue. So, yeah.
That's fascinating. I mean, I read your post on doing it, but I didn't realize quite how much, you know, really played into specifically. I mean, because one of the things you do great in A Blood and Honey is the dialogue. It's very genuine. So what drew you to the, as Duke said, the potato farmers and fantasy?
Boy. You know, potatoes aren't actually indigenous to Ireland, right?
I do know that.
Okay. Anyway, what drew me there was actually a book called Those Are Real Bullets by Peter Pringle and Philip Johnson, which is a nonfiction book about Bloody Sunday. I worked at Book People as a bookseller for 6 years, which is a great background to have when you want to be a writer. because you get to actually see how people choose to buy a book. I can't tell you how valuable an experience that is. Plus, you get to practice every single day elevator pitches, because you have about 10 seconds to convince somebody to look at a book, you know, and maybe about 5 minutes tops talking to them about the book. So it's the same experience as an elevator pitch to an agent or an editor. So you just have to try to think of it as you're pitching someone else's book, not yours. At least I did anyway. But anyway, they have a lot of ARCs floating around in bookstores, and I happened to see that one. And I was doing a lot of research about soldiers during that time for a series I was working on. And I thought, oh, okay, that'll be interesting, because, you know, those are real bullets. It must be about soldiers. Not so much. But I was fascinated by the story, and I was floored by all the things that had happened and during that time period, and how nothing really was done, even though they had witnesses, they had camera, they had film. The gentleman that wrote the book, they're both British reporters. And yet the government, the British government's position to the world at that time, they have since apologized and retracted the statement. But they told the world at the time, and for 30 years afterwards, that these people were terrorists. And honestly, right. they weren't. They were just regular citizens, unarmed, who were protesting. So it was a very scary thing to read about. And I was reading it during the Bush era. And watching what was going on in Wisconsin, and becoming very frightened, because I am, in fact, of a liberal bent, and watching everything just being clamped down like that, and watching American society just be so divided, it reminded me so much of what was going on in Ireland in the 70s. So, oh, there's my cat.
Okay.
But yeah, it reminded me a lot of what was going on in the 70s in Ireland. And I kept thinking, this would be a great lesson for Americans to learn from, actually, if they only knew about it. So I think a lot of Americans are totally unaware of that event. And so part of the reason why I started writing about Ireland, that's really it. Plus, I've always been a little fascinated. When I was a child, I had an Irish babysitter and... neighbors actually from Scotland, one specific neighbor who actually played the bagpipes at dusk.
Wow.
Every day.
Wow.
So it was really neat, really, really neat.
It's actually, I was going to say, it's interesting. We officially have had two people write about the politics of Ireland.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah.
Oh, yes, Celine Kiernan.
That's, her series, the Morhawk trilogy, is a lot of what she's exploring is it's not specifically about Ireland or anything, but the same sort of conflicts, you know, the difficulties and everything, and trying to kind of bring to reality how difficult it is to live in a war-torn country and whatnot.
Yeah.
So,
and she's Irish, so. We had a lot
of fun. She is Irish.
Yeah, I don't have that excuse, I'm afraid. Actually, to tell you the truth, I've never even been to Ireland.
That's, even the most people haven't, probably. You know, it's like, I've got Irish blood, and I've been to England, though. And actually, what's interesting, having, you know, when reading this book, it took me back, in a way, to, I was there in the mid-90s, and, it was very, I mean, you go over being, and I was in London, being very aware of the fact that there could be a bomb threat at any point in time. And, you know, rail lines will get closed down consistently, and a bomb could very well go off, and whatnot. So it was, I had never traveled back from that point, though. I mean, I knew a little bit about the troubles, and more so in a general sense, that, you know, they happened and who the fight was between. And I've looked it up actually since talking to Celine Kiernan a little bit more, because Americans look at it very much as a, you know, a Catholic Protestant thing.
They're wrong. It's more of a class thing.
Right. And like Sean and I specifically, you know, because we're up, it's a lot of what we is are drawn to in literature is class issues and race issues and everything.
That's because we're crazy liberals.
That's probably why. But yeah, the fact that it is a class issue and it was more of a political issue than it was, you know, a religious issue. But because it was framed so well as a religious issue, you know, a lot of probably fairly liberal people would be like, oh, well, it's just the crazy Catholics, you know. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's really, both sides were kind of crazy, just so you know.
And it's interesting that they would think of it in terms of as being a religious religious debate or battle, for lack of a better term, and yet not see the inherent irony in the fact that England has this history of like rejecting those very issues of religion, that they saw the Catholic Church, and part of the removal of the Catholic Church had to do with those very conflicts of that of having little control. And yet here they are doing the exact same things, and like nobody sees the irony in thinking it in this terms. Like the British aren't that dumb; they would have seen the irony. So it's clear like there's so much more going on. But of course, you know that we have a tendency, I think, in this country to sort of reduce issues to easy dichotomies that we can kind of understand. So
yes, we like our binary systems.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do, and Americans tend to think of things more black and white. You know, this is evil, that is good, you know, and really so many things are far more complex than that. And I was watching everyone freak out about the whole terrorist thing and 9/11 and all this. And I was just floored that so many people that I felt were pretty intelligent weren't really thinking very broadly about the issue, about what would the causes be. I mean, is this something that might have happened somewhere else? It instantaneously seemed to become a problem that was all about Americans.
Right.
And like, we had never gone through this before. And I was just like, oh God, really?
Well, we are the center of the universe.
Well, if you remember, like, too, that we bought into the arguments sold to us, which were, like, I mean, not to go on a Bush rant, but Bush did say, you know, they hate our freedom, you know, things like that. And we bought into that because, like,
well, other people might have, but I didn't.
Well, I have to admit to being young and really dumb when 9/11 happened. So I definitely bought into the Patriots. I kind of learned pretty quick. It was like, whoa, this is a lot more complicated. But, you know, that was like, for me, I'd never experienced anything like that. Like I was, I don't know, 6 when the Timothy McVeigh bombings occurred. So I don't remember any of that. I didn't have any connection to it.
Baby.
Shut up. Like,
I'm sorry. No, I was in an interesting position because my husband was in the Air Force. It was his first year in the military. My daughter was 9 months old, and my husband was stationed in Colorado at Cheyenne Mountain Air Force Base. I was here in California. So... And there was the concern, Cheyenne Mountain is one of those places that they tend to lock up whenever anything happens.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He got lucky. It was like he had gotten off shift already, or he wasn't due to come in. I don't remember how it worked, but he luckily was not in the mountain. They shut it down for like 3 days. And I was stuck out here, like I said. And there was huge concerns about, I'm never going to make it home. You know, the security is going to be insane. I've got a baby with me. I'm traveling on my own. This is not cool. But, and the reaction of the military, of members of the military was definitely, they tend to go uber patriotic to an extent, except the Air Force kind of tends to be a little bit more liberal, the people in it. Mm-hmm. But there was still,
because there's more distance between them and the enemy, as it were. So they can actually afford me.
Right, because they tend to the Air Force is they're the technological force. They actually don't fly that much, which is kind of was an interesting misconception that I learned when I first got in. But it was more that you know, my position was and always has been, I've always been a skeptic of the United States and our narrative. You know, I don't know what time I started, but I think it had something to do with the American Indian Movement. I was kind of obsessed with it. And so when it started coming out, oh, you know, this is a terrible tragedy, I'm going, okay, yes, I recognize it as a terrible tragedy, but we have to look at the motivations of the people who did this. And I am pretty sure that those motivations are not going to be cut and dried. They might be from our position.
I'm totally not in my head right now. Yes, absolutely, yes.
I mean, they never are. Nobody's motivations are ever cut and dried. But like you said, I mean, it's my father refuses to watch gang shows. He would probably, it's really a bummer because he would hate your book. He loves, I mean, it's like, to me, I'm like, Dad, you have to read this book. But if I think about it, he probably would hate it because Of Blood and Honey is very gray. Your characters are very conflicted, and nothing is as easy as it appears. I mean, and that's one of the nice things about this, because we're totally going off questions at this point and whatever, but I found it interesting that you decided to go in that direction, considering that you kind of have a binary system, a couple of binary systems working within the book, because you have, you know, the Catholic Church, so heaven versus hell, basically, Christianity versus paganism, Catholic versus Protestant, Ireland versus Britain, but they all complicate each other.
But that's reality. That's reality.
Right. So, I mean, I was curious though, if that was something that, you know, you set out to doing specifically, that you really wanted to explore reality, or was it more of a, you know, organic destination based on where you set your urban environment?
That's just how I am. I like looking at the complexities of issues. That's one of the things that my players in my D&D campaign got very used to, I have to say. That's just how I think and how I like to look at things. I try to think along a bigger picture. I think if you restrict things to us versus them, it's kind of lazy writing, in my opinion. I'm sure it can be fun when you're playing like a video game or something like that, but really, I think it's important for people to look at things, particularly these days when people are being frightened by constantly running on a low level of anxiety because of all of the news stories that present things as, you know, hi, there's this boogeyman out there to get you personally. When people are able to make you frightened, they're able to make you make just bad mistakes. You're more likely to make bad mistakes and bad choices because you're panicked. And I'm of the opinion that stopping and thinking is generally a good thing. So, whoops, we lost somebody, didn't we?
No, something happened. Something happened.
Huh.
That's okay.
Okay. So anyway.
Question though. You don't have a lot of Protestant characters in
no
the book. And right. Was that something that, I mean, did you think that complicated it almost too much, or was it just not something you wanted to look at? Or I mean to an extent, yes, it's a very complicated system, and you can't, I mean, I came through knowing that I couldn't look at the Protestants as the bad guys, even though they are the bad guys. Did you want to avoid I'm that's not the right word. But you tended to put them in that position, even though there is that awareness of, well, obviously they're not completely bad, and you explore that a little bit. But I'm rambling now.
Could you put it in? Question. I mean, could you think of it in terms of that maybe it's not the avoidance, it's that who our central character is.
Right.
We're viewing a lot of that through his perspective. And of course, you get a lot of that apprehension. Like, I have not quite finished the book, but I apologize for that. But one of the parts that I've just finished is the first his first real job with the IRA. And he shoots this guy, the constable. He shoots him in the face and kills him. And, you know, they're running away, but he keeps questioning. He's thinking inside his mind, like, oh my gosh, did that guy have a family? Like, was he one of those, like, Catholics who joined to sort of change things, you know, maybe misguided to do it? You know, he's questioning all of these things, but yet we, you know, so it's sort of maybe it's in that perspective that, yes, we see the Protestants as bad, but maybe because everything that happens to this character doesn't lead him to see many of the good, even though he's trying to see it. He's trying to see the human behind it, and yet he's getting shoved in prison for what essentially are bogus charges, and knows people who have gotten killed, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, would you agree that that's a logical assessment, Stina?
Well, I think I understand what you're asking. You're kind of asking, I selected the Catholic side of the story for a reason. And the reason I selected that side of the story is because it's not as frequently told, and was, in fact, suppressed for many, many, many years. There are people who lived through this who are dying now, and their stories are going to vanish. That aspect of history is going to be gone. As they say, history is written by the victors.
Right.
And it was very difficult to do research in this particular on this particular subject, because the history is so heavily slanted in one direction, which is the Protestant direction. So I specifically chose to tell the story from a Catholic point of view for that reason. Luckily, I was able to get a contact in West Belfast through the Irish language online, the Irish language school online, which I believe is centered in New York. And he was able to mail me books that I wouldn't have been able to get a hold of here. That were it was next to impossible to find here. And you would think it would be relatively easy because of the internet or whatever, but I didn't even know what to look for, frankly. So without Brian, I really couldn't have... I couldn't have done it.
So then was your decision to, did you go with the Catholic thing first and then come to the complication of the, you know, the fallen? I'm just curious.
One of the things that I find particularly fascinating about Ireland is that paganism and Christianity have lived side by side pretty much since Christianity showed up. Granted, it's been an easy sort of residence, shared residence, as it were, but they didn't totally eradicate paganism there like they did here. I think largely because here paganism never really got established. The Christians showed up, and there were Indians who had their own religion and so forth, but all of that was just immediately them versus us and smashed down. In Ireland, people go to mass or whatever and then come home and leave milk out for the fae. That's very evident in a lot of the reading that you do about Ireland. So I always thought that was really fascinating, which is, you know, and I was raised Catholic. So I just find that whole thing, that whole dichotomy, just really interesting. So that's why I chose to go that route with that.
Go ahead, Duke. Sorry.
Oh, no, because you're probably going to ask a follow-up to this specific question, so go.
Well, I mean, I was just going to say that it was... I mean, the mythology of the, you know, the British Isles period is, you know, it's a very rich mythology. But I mean, you're right that there aren't a lot of places that still hold, they cling sort of to the old beliefs. But I found it interesting that, you know, were there Protestant Irish? I mean, obviously there were, correct?
Sure. Basically, Protestantism came with plantationism. I believe that's the gotcha. Term. Right. During the Elizabethan era. So originally, they were of Scottish descent. They came from Scotland largely, and were set up by the British government to. And the lands were taken away from Irish Catholics and given to the Scottish Protestants.
Right.
Which is why some circles try to keep themselves very separate, and others, it's like, what's the point? We're all Celts.
Right.
So, I don't know if that answers your question, but...
Well, the question then is you know, because you've set up a partnership between the Catholic side and the Fae. Because of this, you know, and it's a fairly logical in the book outcome, because they're both fighting against the same thing. And the Fallen have chosen to become the Protestants. I mean, I'm complicating the issue probably. But is it typical then for Protestants as well to hold to the older beliefs? Or is it only something that typically happens between like the Catholic communities and whatnot, or is that something that's Ireland wide, basically?
I don't know that I can authoritatively answer that question, because again, I've not actually lived in that culture, so I don't know. But based on what I've read, I would assume that yes, across Ireland wide, that is absolutely true. Unlike the United States, a lot of Christians in the United States like to associate Catholicism with paganism. I don't feel that I don't know. I'm a Catholic, so I'm ex-Catholic, sorry. I'm ex-Catholic, so I have certain, we'll just say, buttons regarding that issue, but...
No, agreed. My mother's a, you know, former Catholic herself, so...
I can't tell you how many times I've had ridiculous conversations with... people who have told me to my face that Catholics weren't Christians.
Oh yeah, that one's always fun. Well, I mean, and that's actually a fairly typical thing happening in the United States. It's the whole reason that John F. Kennedy was like such a shocking outcome in terms of being elected. You know, he's Catholic. He can't be president because that's not a real Christian. And now it's the conversation of Mormons aren't real Christians. Well, I think it's tends to be the Baptists, but sorry, Baptists, but you do tend to do that.
Yeah, I would go with that. And honestly, I live in the Bible Belt, which makes it, I have to say, even worse. And for the record, I did try out that whole Southern Baptist thing for 3 years. I did. So I can speak with authority on that one.
Anyway, so I totally lost our questions. Yeah. We have them somewhere.
Oh, no, they're there. Just for the record, I live in the town where that guy tried to burn copies of the Quran. So, since we're throwing out, like, our badges of honor for living in crazy religious places. Yeah.
I don't live in a crazy religious place, though.
I know, but you don't have any badges of honor. That's the point.
Damn.
Actually, I want to go back to the historical, because I had a question about that, which was... since you said it was difficult to sort of do research on this, or since a lot of what is out there is slanted in favor of the British occupation, did you find it then difficult to keep your story sort of historically accurate? And, you know, not just because it's in a historical period, the Ireland in the 70s, but also in trying to like bring in these fantastic elements, because you have things like the Fae and what are called the Fallen, you know, the Fallen Angels, and there's a lot of that fantastic stuff, but it's like embedded within this historical period, which, and I've described it as kind of like living in times that don't make very much sense, because the main character, like, things happen that just don't make a lot of sense to him. So was that sort of a difficult process, or?
Yes, it was very intense. At the same, I want to definitely say that I'm completely fascinated by that time period. I find it very, very interesting. And so reading about it was not even remotely a trial. The thing that terrified me the most, I think, and was so stressful, was knowing that I was dealing with a very sensitive subject and being very careful to not tread on bad things that would cause bad reactions. There's so much when you read about that time period there, it's quite obvious that there is so much of it that isn't explained in the books, in any of the research that you do, until you actually speak with someone who lived then and who was immersed in that culture. So things like Protestants and Catholics being able to tell the difference between, you know, who is what group across the street, from across the street, someone on a bus drives by and they can tell the difference sometimes. And it's like, 80% of the time they can tell the difference. It's really clear on job applications when somebody applies for a job, because unemployment among Catholics in that area was astronomical.
Right.
We're going through a tough time now with unemployment, but what we're going through is nothing. It's a walk in the park compared to what they were going through. But it's, none of that is explained in any way in any of the written research of that time. So basically I had to go to Brian and ask him about that. And that was in and of itself very stressful, because again, I don't live to upset people, or I don't take pride in hurting people's feelings. I think that that's just not a good thing. I mean, being polite courtesy doesn't cost you anything. So anyway, it was really hard because Brian was like, oh yeah, we have a neighborhood list and, you know, you can ask us whatever questions you want and I'll put it to the neighborhood and see what happens. And sure enough, I mean, I was just like, oh, this is what an opportunity. I mean, thank goodness for the web. When would that ever happen, you know? So one of the first questions I had to really think hard, I spent 2 days trying to figure out how to say, how do you tell the difference without being insulting in any way? I was terrified. And when the email came back, I was just so freaked out. My husband had to read it for me. So it was very difficult, very stressful and very difficult. But my favorite science fiction and fantasy runs a commentary in a way of the times that it's written in, like Fahrenheit 451, all of that stuff. I think it's really important. That's one of science fiction fantasy's best traditions, I think, to address sensitive subjects by using story. And I think it's really, bless you, I think it's really important that we think about these things. And thinking about it within the framework of a story gives us a bit of distance from sensitive issues and makes it easier to address, I think. So I felt like it was very important to do, but it was very difficult. And very stressful.
I can imagine. I mean, that's actually one of the very refreshing things about this, especially as an urban fantasy. And I hate knocking urban fantasy, but
steal my question.
it has, I'm sorry, but it really has tended to become kind of fluffy. even the dark urban fantasy tends to be kind of fluffy because it's not really exploring that many issues. It's exploring darkness for the sake of exploring darkness or whatever. But you have some incredibly difficult things going on. I mean, not just in terms of the larger picture of you know, the conflict, but what is happening to these individuals. I mean, I don't want to get too spoilery about it, but I mean, there's two incredibly big things that happened to Liam and to his wife. And those, you know, those are a difficult topic outside of literature. You know, those are difficult for normal people on a day-to-day basis to talk about. And you put them right out there for the world to see and to deal with. Was it more difficult, do you think, to write about the conflict, or more difficult to write about the very personal experiences of your characters?
In some cases, I have to say, I think I know which incidents you're talking about. There were certain moments in that book where I had to just write a couple of lines and then get up and walk away. Right. And then come back and then write a couple of more lines and then get up and walk away. Because it was just that difficult to write about.
Right.
So I have to say those issues specifically were far more difficult in that way. But overall, stressy-wise, I at least knew that I was in within a certain familiar framework, if that makes sense.
Right.
When you're writing about a completely different culture and one that you've never really experienced yourself, it's that in and of itself is a whole level of stress. But
did you worry at all that, and you probably did, but did you worry at all that, I mean, the first one is very black and white. The first thing that happens to Liam, that's it's awful. Like, nobody would question whether it's not. But the second issue with Mary Kate and Father Murray, that is one of those totally morally ambiguous situations. Did you worry that putting it into, I mean, even as a story of conflict, did you worry that the inclusion of what can almost be seen as controversial issues, that even the Liam beginning, not spoiling anything, trying, that can even be seen as controversial because of his gender. Were you worried about that in terms of selling this book, or it not just to the publisher or to your editor, but to the general public?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, initially my agent had a great deal of trouble trying to sell the manuscript. Well, I say a great deal of trouble. It took a couple of extra months, I guess. People repeatedly and told him that this is a very good book, but wow, you know, that part there in chapter 3 is just really tough. And people are just not going to be able to handle that. So, but my agent really believed in the book, thank goodness. Being a new writer is really hard because you're inclined to say, yes, whatever you want, just buy the book. having an agent is just the best thing that ever happened to me. Absolutely. He stood up to all of them and said, look, without chapter 3, Liam is just a murderer. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So it has to be there no matter what. And for me, writing about that issue, a lot of it had to do with the fact that I get, being a female, I get really, really tired of certain things happening to female characters and nobody even blinks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
we're talking... I mean, it's not that far in the book. Do we have to talk about it in cryptic terms, or can we just...
Can we just say it?
I guess not. We can say it.
I'm assuming we're talking about the scene where Liam is raped.
Yes. And okay. That really does feed the rest of his character. I mean, his transformation. Although, I didn't see it as the straw that broke the camel's back, per se.
No, I think it's the second time he goes that things happen to him.
Yes.
That not in that stripe. Now I'm going to get vague because that isn't it's a, but you know, other things happen to him that happen for the same reasons as the first time he goes to prison, right? Which is no reason, just made up reasons. And that's the thing that just basically he's done. He's done. He's now going to join up.
Yeah, he's Irish in the wrong place at the wrong time, as they say.
Right.
So
you're right, though, like that issue, the issue of rape, you know, you were saying that it with Liam, it's like it's a complete shift because this is something that is maybe not as common in literature to see a man experiencing this kind of, I guess, a violation or however you want to describe it. It's more left for women. And then, of course, there's all this talk about how do you write about rape and how do you do it? And you're right. A lot of literature just sort of like, well, she's raped and like whatever, and like just moves on and like deals with the after effects or whatever, right?
Well, exactly, and it's kind of a trope, really, for the hero to have a female in his life who is raped, and so he must go out and seek revenge and la la la, and it's ridiculous that it's treated so. For me, it's horrible. I mean, speaking as a female, I couldn't get through Book of Eli because it came out five different times that I counted, and I had to walk out of the theater. But that was just, you know, a matter of course. So I wanted the males out there to understand what that feels like. I really did. So I wanted them to see how awful it really truly is. And then when certain events happen later on, that put that in more into a context, right? So that's why, in part, that's only part of the reason why I wrote about that. Another reason that I wrote about it was that if you read about the hunger strikers and the things that were going on in the prisons at that time, it's there between the lines. Nobody actually says, hey, guards raped people. But let me tell you what, it's there.
It usually is, sadly. I mean,
yeah.
Kind of one of those lovely...
Well, it goes on with the Stanford prison study, which they just did, I think it's called the Stanford prison study, where they just actually re-interviewed some of the people who are in that study, because it's like the 30th anniversary or some craziness. But, you know, that you put people in these different positions of power and that those things just sort of fall into place because they're assumed to be a part of that position. And, like, that's part of that study is you put a bunch of just average Joes as prisoners and other ones as the guards or what have you. And they just start falling into the roles and fulfilling the same things that happen in prisons all the time. It's, like, inherent to the human condition in some bizarre, sick way.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I agree. I took psychology in college for 3 years, so I remember that study.
It's
very
scary.
Very well. It's terrifying, and it just comes back down to absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's the old standard, right?
Yeah.
So you mentioned briefly that, you know, you wanted men to get it. Do you think this book is more written for men than it is for women, in a sense?
In a sense it is, because I feel like I'm talking about things that women just understand because we live with it every day. So, yes, in a way, yes, I do feel like it's written more for men than women. But I feel like... being female, that's just that. I don't know. I mean, there's the relationship between Bran and Kathleen. I mean, what female is not going to understand that? You know.
I loved the Liam and his wife. Their conversations that reminded me of so many conversations with my husband. It wasn't even funny, and I don't even have to go through the rhythm method. So. I'm just...
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man, I have to say one of my favorite scenes is when she tries to fend off Liam with a thermometer. That was awesome.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Yes, that was hilarious. I appreciated those moments. I mean, like I said, I mean, one of the, I think in a way, yes, this book was, it probably will appeal to men, as an urban fantasy specifically, which I think tends to be written for women. But as a woman, I really appreciated that it wasn't your stereotypical urban fantasy, because I am getting really, really sick of it. Personally,
I'm just going to come out and say this. I don't like romance. I just don't. I mean, it's nothing against romance. I just don't like it as a genre, and I never have. I mean, it's just like anybody not liking sports. I don't like sports right. either. Generally, there's certain specific exceptions to that rule in both cases, but I really don't like romance. So this creep of romance into science fiction fantasy, I mean, for me, urban fantasy is Charles de Lint. It's, you know what I mean? Yeah. So I don't know. It kind of bugs me when somebody says that my book is not urban fantasy, because it's not romance.
No, it's definitely urban fantasy. It just doesn't have romance in it. You know, it had a very real relationship to me. I mean, like, I go through life going, I read urban fantasy going, oh, there's another romance. Honey, you want to romance? No. Okay, no romance. You know, it's like you look at your spouse and you're like, yes, romance. And then because you're reading these books that are so unattainably romantic, and you're, by the end of it, I just want to throw them away and burn them and be like, and beat my husband with them and all sorts of things, you know.
So wait, let me get this straight. Reading typical urban fantasy makes you want to commit spousal abuse.
Yes.
Wow. It doesn't make me want that at all. It makes me want to throw the book across the room, actually.
That too. I just usually target my husband in the process.
And I think maybe it's not so much that there's romance, because there is, if you want to take it at a very general sense, there is romance in this book. It's maybe the way romance is treated, that it's, we get to it and we go, this sounds cheesy, or this sounds like, oh my gosh, I saw this coming, or, you know, we have all these things where we just look at it and go, this is not real life.
Yes.
Right. That's my main issue with romance, is it does not treat relationships as anything like real life. It's an idealistic impossibility. That's my sense of it. There are very few romance writers who do not do that, and those are ones that don't make me want to throw up. But largely, I don't like romance, because I have a real relationship with a man, and I know that men are not anything like what most romance men are like. And I love men. I think men are fabulous. And why would women want to remake them? They're fascinating and interesting and fun to be with as it is. Why would you want to remake them into what are basically women with penises? I don't get that. I don't get it.
That's not controversial at all.
No, Now, and then comes the hate mail. I'm sorry.
No, I think it's hilarious. It really, I mean, in a lot of ways, Liam reminded me very much of my husband. And it was really nice seeing just a genuine couple in an urban fantasy. Something that wasn't, you know, I mean, it's conflicted, but not in the I want you, you want me, let's go have sex, you know, conflicted sort of way. Because, you know, it's like we love each other because we are conflicted. I'm sorry. It's one of those tropes of urban fantasy that drives me insane. And yet at the same time, I find completely alluring. It pisses me off.
Now, I just, there was a certain series that I got up to, I think book five or something, and I was just, and the main character kept debating about whether or not she was going to sleep with someone, and I was just like, really? Who cares? I mean, you've been debating this for four damn books now. Would you just sleep with the woman already and just get it over with? Nobody really cares. It's not like it's that shocking. Just do it. So, you know, yeah. The entirety of Chicago. Nobody cares.
Oh, yeah, we can't tell what series you're talking about at all.
Oh, oops. I should have been more. Can you edit that out? really, that... I mean, really, to each their own. Everybody, some people really get into that, and that's their thing. And there's, it's nothing against them. I just happen to find it annoying because it's a lazy way of trying to keep the sexual tension going, right?
Forever. Yeah. And although I do love it in my Bones show, and
Bones? Yeah, it's Bones. Bones is great. But I have. I'm an Aries. I'm very impatient with people. It's like, you know, if you're gonna go do the horizontal mambo, just do it already. Just please, for the love of Pete, just get it over with.
that's why I really liked Battlestar Galactica, because it's not a show that is really about romance or about coupling or whatever you want to call it.
Oh, and that's a great series. The British series, Coupling, that's hysterical.
but with BSG, it's, I mean, you have these various couples come together. They get together, but some of them, they all are so complicated in their relationships with one another. Jen hasn't seen the whole series yet, but she'll get to stuff.
Sure, I know it's complicated. It's because it's a good series.
You're gonna get relationships in it that don't develop for like three seasons, precisely because of who those people are and what is required of them through the whole series.
That's fine.
I'm fine with that too. I mean, as long as there is an actual motivation within the character that prevents them from acting on whatever it is they're hesitating upon, that makes sense to me. But if it's quite clear that the author is just doing it because they know that once that they do the nasty, the tension is going to be gone for whatever reason, and they can't come up with another reason to have sexual tension, it bugs me. It's just one of those times when I glimpse the man behind the curtain, as it were, and wish I couldn't. You know what I mean?
Because he's got all the strings, and you don't want to see the strings.
No, not as a reader. You don't want to see the strings. So, romance isn't for me for a whole multitude of reasons, but nothing against romance, and nothing against people who like it. It just isn't for me. And that's why I very specifically chose a male character over a female main character, because I really didn't want, I knew I was going to have enough trouble as it was just being a female writer who was writing urban fantasy. Right. And I have had a great deal of trouble for that reason. People pick it up assuming it's going to be a romance, and romance readers, trust me, are very, very set in, just like science fiction fantasy readers. They have very set ideas, of very set expectations. And in romance with a capital R, you cannot call a romance with a capital R without a happy ending. And if they do not get their happy ending, they get very vocal and very upset about it. Just like in science fiction, you know, if you're trying to write a hard science fiction novel and you don't actually have real science in it, hard science fiction fans will go nuts. They will. So it's not like it's you know, unique to romance or whatever. But so hopefully I'm putting that, hopefully it makes more sense. But I do get a lot of crap from that arena because my book is not a romance book. And then at the same time, I also get it from the other side because I am a female writing urban fantasy. So the expectation is that, you know, it's got fallen angels in it and I'm a female writer. Ooh, it must be romance.
Oh, they must be having sex with the fallen angels.
Yes, exactly. Which my characters don't.
Even though they're not supposed to, and they're not supposed to get pregnant because they're really dead and they're like God's children. And then, oh, but she does secretly in book four and has a kid and has to be converted to a fallen... I'm sorry, were we... I'm probably not talking the same...
again, to each their own. I mean, if that's what they enjoy, that's fine. That's no big deal. It's just not for me. Right. And I really have had a lot of problems because people have been very upset with me on both sides because I did not choose to write as expected. And it just, it bothers me a great deal. I'm a feminist, but I'm also a conflicted feminist because, you know, that's just how it is. My belief is that women should be able to write whatever it is they want to write. They shouldn't be restricted to anything. So it really annoys me when people try to bully me into writing romance. It's just not what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
And so that bugs me. And it also bothers me when I get the whole, you're female, you must write romance, from the other side too. So it's just been a very, very difficult road on all sorts of things. But I mean, it's worth it. I love writing so much and I love books. I've loved them since, and I'm dyslexic. Although as a child, they didn't know what that was then. So I had a great deal of problems learning how to read. And for a time, I just didn't want to because it was so hard. But then I understood that reading was kind of this gateway to this other world where I could go run around and play and be free from all sorts of things and learn all sorts of interesting things and travel without actually traveling and experience things without really actually experiencing them. And I was sucked in second grade. That was it.
Well, your book definitely sucked us in. It definitely sucked me in. So, I think you have successfully, crossed into the world of creating worlds for people who want to explore things. So we should probably wrap it up. I hate doing it because I really could talk for hours. But unfortunately our listeners don't usually want to listen for hours. They're bastards. Anyway, but we do want to know, is there going to be a second book in this series? If it's going to be a series and, you know, what have you got, you know, coming out soon or not soon, but you know, what are you working on then? Tell us about it.
The second book I just turned in to my agent, and it's going through the editing process right now.
Yay.
It should come out in spring of 2012.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
All right. We expect review copies, just so you know.
Oh, no problem.
We will bring you back and make you our podcast slaves.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
But in the nicest possible way.
Yeah, don't go misery on me. I like having both feet.
Don't worry, you don't hurt feet. We have chains with silk on them. So
I see.
Yeah, suddenly very creeped out by Sean. Just
sorry.
Saying.
It's your fault, Jen. You somebody showed me that video about the public service announcement about going to conventions dressed as Princess Leia.
Oh my God, that was hilarious. We'll share it with you. Don't worry. Anyway, anything else? So you have book two. Are you working on anything else?
Yes, actually, I'm working on another series that will be for it'll be categorized as YA, but it'll be for the older end of the spectrum of YA.
Right.
It'll be set in a world that has a more Georgian era flavor to it, and it's well, let's see, one part, oh, I don't know, that first book. The second book is more of a one part mystery, one part, you know, fantasy book. So it's kind of a police procedural / fantasy, the second book is. But the first book is more about, it's more of your standard, I guess, big fantasy, as it were. So princes and nations falling and empires and that whole thing.
Oh, that's
yeah. Cool. And because it's me, lots and lots of racism and classism. Because,
oh,
you know,
perfect.
Yeah.
Don't read Celine Kiernan's books, though, because then it might influence you in a different direction. I'm just kidding.
Oh, really?
And I'm not kidding, but yeah, no, it's kind of what she does in hers, but hers is not, I wouldn't say that it's very historical.
No, I mean, her stuff is fairly,
it's very high fantasy.
Yeah, very high fantasy, or it masks itself as high fantasy,
yes.
But like, it tricks you. It's really clever in that way, because from the start, you think, oh, this is going to be like
high fantasy.
Court fantasy, and like, there's talking cats, and oh, it's so cute. And then it's like, whoa.
Whoa, not so cute. Okay. Yeah, it was good. Definitely worth reading. Read it. We're plugging you, Celine. We love you. Okay, sorry. Yeah. Well, good to know that you've got some, it sounds like you've got some great things coming out soon-ish, so that's fantastic. So last but not least, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Yes, www.cslight.com is my website, and usually the part of that website that is most often updated, and I fully admit that the whole rest of that site needs to be redone, but I have a blog that I frequently update. So
fantastic. Cool. So, all right. So if anybody wants to let us know, like, if you've read Stina's book, or I don't know, ask us a question and we can pretend to be Stina and answer for you, you know. you could do that in three ways. You can send us an email.
SkippyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can leave a comment on our blog.
What is it? SkippyandFanty.wordpress.com?
Amateur.
I know, I forget every week.
Or you can send us a tweet.
Twitter.com/SkippyandFanty.
And apparently we're on Google+ now, but I don't really know what the address is. So just look for Skiffy Fanty on
Skiffy Fanty, because I don't think they have a way to create pages for things that are not people yet. So
yeah, so we're just Skiffy Fanty.
Although somebody called us Skiffy Farty.
Yeah, great.
Wow.
Well,
clearly never saw Firefly.
I love Firefly.
I love Firefly, too.
But I'm missing the reference. What about Firefly?
You're kidding, right?
I'm not. I've only watched the series once, to be honest.
Communist.
I'm sorry. I feel so bad now.
Skip and Fanty are the twins. The twins.
Oh.
You know, the ones that they, oh God.
Mingo and Fanty.
Hello.
My God, I totally have to go watch it again now. I had no idea. Wow. I
can always tell the difference between us. And you know, well, Mingo or Fanty's the pretty one or whatever. I can't remember the exact joke, but yeah.
Yeah, Fanty's the pretty one.
Well, that's good, because I'm definitely the pretty one out of this relationship. And I got stuck with Fanty, so I'll take it now. I'm not taking Farty, though. I'm just saying.
Whatever. Well, thanks so much for being on the show and talking with us, Stina.
Thank you for having me on the show. It was a lot of fun. I really did enjoy it.
And we enjoyed you.
And hopefully tons of horrible hate mail.
We love hate mail. We don't get any mail because people don't like us very much. But you might get hate mail, and that's all that matters.
This is great. So we will see you all next week. I don't really know what's going on. Jen knows everything that's going on. We're interviewing someone.
I don't remember what's going on next week.
Oh, well, this is very professional of us. We have no idea what's coming up.
We are interviewing someone. Who are we interviewing?
Is it Philippa Ballantyne?
I think it... No, she's later.
We'll figure this out on our own time. So we will see y'all next week. Thanks again, Stina. And yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
And scene. Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.